There's nothing worse than wearing clothes that don't fit right. That's why Tomboy X makes size and gender inclusive underwear, swimwear, and loungewear for all bodies. Queer founded and run for over 10 years, you can trust they know a thing or two about making the perfect pair. Feel comfortable in your own skin. Shop online today and use code IHEART for 20% off your first purchase. Only at TomboyX.com. Tomboy X. Fit for you just as you are.
You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
On the Bechdel cast, the questions asked, if movies have women in them, are all their discussions just boyfriends and husbands, or do they have individualism? The patriarchy's effing vast, start changing it with the Bechdel cast.
Hello and welcome to the Bechdel cast. My name is Caitlin Durante.
And my name is Jamie Loftus.
And you're listening to this podcast right now. Did you know that it is about the representation of women in film, examining that representation from an intersectional feminist lens?
I did know that.
Oh, good. Wow.
But it's always a pleasure to be. Well, it's not. We're together. What was that like? Corny quarantine hashtag. Hashtag alone together. I'm like feeling mostly alone, but it is nice to see. It's nice to see you both. You know, we're together in a sense.
Sure.
Yes.
Digitally. Wow.
I can now only get Zoom to work on my phone, and then sometimes my phone gets really hot. So look forward to that.
Anyway, great. We're off
anyways,
to a great
this
start.
Is the Bechdel cast.
We use the Bechdel test as a jumping off point. And
yes.
Traditionally, the Bechdel test determines whether or not two named women speak to each other about something other than a man. We are approaching it a little differently moving forward, which is that do two people of marginalized genders speak to each other about something other than a man? And that is...
Yes.
You know, just a way to broaden the test and make it a little bit more inclusive.
I don't think Alison Bechdel would disagree.
Yeah, I think she would.
That's who made the test.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Sorry, I forgot to mention that part.
I wonder about that sometimes because Alison Bechdel is so awesome. But then do you ever wonder, like, because she wrote it in a single comic and then she's like, and that is my...
That's the thing.
It's like if you said something like smart offhand and then someone was still talking to you about, there was a podcast about it 30 years later. Anyways,
it's kind of, that'll be like if in 30 years from now, someone has a podcast called Cat Facts with Caitlin.
Right.
And I'll be like, that's the thing you took away from my whole my body of work.
You're like, I mean, it's all well and good, but there was more there. No, that's on us. I'm so excited for today's episode.
Yes, we have a guest who we're super excited about as well.
All the way from Brooklyn, New York.
She's a comedian, a writer, and co-host of Bad Romance Podcast. It's Jordaine Searles.
Hi.
Hello.
Welcome.
Thank you for being here. Mango Margarita?
Yes.
Hell yes.
What a good addition.
Stoked
to the
have
show.
You.
So we're covering Set It Off.
Yes.
The 1996 film. Jordaine, what is your relationship, your history with this movie?
This is just one of the movies that I grew up with. I don't even remember the first time that I watched it. I've watched it a million times since I was born in 92. And, you know, so I feel like this came out in 96. And the moment that it hit cable, I was watching it all the time and it would play on BET. Mm-hmm. And I've always liked it, but it's only recently that I've started to appreciate it in a different light, just because, like, I think it was around the time, like, after Girls Trip, where people were talking about, oh, when was the last time that a bunch of women were in a movie together and it did really well? And the only other times that I could think of was Waiting to Exhale and Set It Off. And I couldn't think of anything before that, where it was just, like, more than one Black woman, you know, on the poster.
Right.
Yeah.
So I was thinking about it a lot, and then I recently rewatched it and then bought it. So now I own it, and I am very happy about that. And also, since, like, I'm queer, I appreciate Queen Latifah's character way more than I did when I was a kid and I did not know that I was queer.
Can't wait to talk about it more. Jamie, yes. What's your history with it?
This is one of the many movies that I have seen in parts on cable TV, but I'd never sat down and watched it all the way through beginning to end. I've seen many of the iconic scenes, but I had never taken in the full movie. And holy shit, this movie is so great. Like, I there's so much going on. Researching the production of the movie was very interesting as well. Like, this movie has everything going for it. And expectedly, it was reviewed by, like, older white male film critics. Incredibly weird. The Rotten Tomatoes, you know, gap between audience and critic is telling. It's,
sure.
I loved it. What's your history, Caitlin?
I had not seen this before, and I'm mad at myself that it took me so long to see it because, I mean, heist movies are right up my alley. Female-driven heist movies are even more up my alley. So few of them exist. So again, I'm bummed I slept on this for so long, but I'm glad I've finally seen it because this movie rules. And it makes such important commentary and just does a lot of really cool stuff. So, yeah, I'm excited to talk about it.
Yeah.
So, should we just dive into the recap and go from there?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. So, we meet Frankie, Vivica A. Fox. She works at a bank that gets robbed by an acquaintance of hers. This robbery turns into a violent, bloody shootout. Mm-hmm. Because she knew the robber, she gets fired, and she is suspected of collusion by the police. The main person there is Detective Strode, played by John C. McGinley, thinks that she is
involved.
Am
I supposed to know who he is? Oh, he was in...
He's in Scrubs.
He was on Scrubs, yeah. But he's in, a lot of these, like, cop movies, too. If you, like, look back at the 90s, he's in a lot of them.
He's got resting cop face. It makes sense.
He does.
The first thing I saw him in was Office Space.
Oh.
He plays one of the Bobs, and that's what I know him most from.
Well, I don't like him.
Yeah, his character, I have a whole spiel on, like, the friendly white male cop trope in media.
Absolutely hate it.
Yeah.
It feels, like, out of place in this movie, too. It was,
Right, like, why it didn't...
Yeah. It doesn't make sense also because his partner is a Black woman and she does nothing and says nothing.
Nothing! I kept waiting for... I was watching it with my boyfriend. I'm like, any second now, we're going to get some information about her character. And it just never comes. It never comes. The same way I was waiting for Cleo's girlfriend to speak aloud the entire movie. I'm like, she's going to speak in this scene.
She never
sure.
says a word, I don't think.
It almost starts to feel like the movie is playing a joke on you because they cut to her so much.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think we ever see her say a word. Anyway, but yeah, the cop is... The way that the tone of the movie treats the cop is like, this feels like a studio note.
And then I'm getting very ahead of myself, but the other detective, Detective Waller.
Yeah, his partner.
I kept thinking the movie was going to end with because I hadn't seen it before. I was like, okay, here's what's going to happen. They're going to rob the one last bank. Detective Waller is going to show up and be like, maybe catch them or something, but she's going to be like, you know what? You go on ahead. I'll just pretend like I didn't see you. And then she lets them go because, like, she's like, I get it. But that doesn't happen.
She, like, redeems herself, sort of, kind of.
No, yeah, right. John C. McGinley gets that note. He's the one that, like, it's so strange. Like, what is even the point of her being in it at all? Because, I mean, at least, like, I don't know, like, I've watched, you know, a bunch of black movies from the 90s from this time, and a lot of them talk about how black cops are complicit in enforcing white supremacy. We see this in Boys in the Hood as well, like, especially in Boys in the Hood. And so it's weird that this movie doesn't seem to question her, except for the scene at the very beginning when Vivica, like, looks at her and, like, says something to her. I don't remember what she says, but
she's like, you didn't even offer me a drink of water or something like that.
Yeah, and it's just like, and that's the only part that we get. But I mean, other movies were way more, I guess, thoughtful about that. But I mean, that's like, that just goes into my one big issue with the movie, is that it likes cops too much, and while also making cops look really incompetent. So it just doesn't make sense to like them so much when they're so bad at their jobs.
Cannot make sense of it.
Yeah, the vibe is very much like, well, they're bad at their job and they're murderers, but you gotta love them. And it's like, we don't gotta love them. We don't.
Right.
I don't know what to make of it. And it does seem like that scene with Detective Waller and with Vivica A. Fox at the very beginning, it seems like that is setting up something that will come back.
Mm-hmm.
But it's never, this particular dynamic is never set off.
Right.
Oh, I wonder if there's like a scene. That's great. That was great.
They never set it off, Jamie?
But yeah, I wonder if there is a scene that was cut.
Yeah. Right, like, it sounds like from the research I did on the production, it seems like this movie went through many, many drafts. So it, for when stuff like that kind of flagged for me of like, this feels like a something that we kind of lost in the middle, I'm just assuming it's that, but I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's more to discuss there, but so we meet three friends who we soon discover are Frankie's friends, but it's Stoney, Jada Pinkett Smith, Cleo is Queen Latifah, and Tashan is Kimberly Elise. And they work together as janitors at an upscale hotel. They are all struggling financially. Stoney's younger brother Stevie, played by Chaz Lamar Shepard, reveals that he's unable to go to college after all because he didn't get a scholarship, and they were all hoping that he would be able to go to college and get out of this cycle of poverty. So that's kind of a big devastation for Stoney, especially because she helped raise them after their parents died. And then Tashan has a young child. She can't afford to pay for the babysitter. And then Cleo's stakes are perhaps a little lower than everyone else in that she seems to mostly just want to fix up her car. But those are kind of the what's at stake from a financial situation for these characters.
Right.
Cleo thinks that they should rob a bank because the guy who robbed Frankie's bank at the beginning made off with like $20,000.
Mm-hmm.
No one else thinks it's a good idea yet. Then we see a scene with this creepy car salesman who wants Stoney to come work for him. And he wants other stuff from her too, mainly sexual favors. She needs an advance, but he'll only give it to her in exchange for sex. And she's desperate, so she has sex with him, only to find out that her brother lied and didn't get into UCLA at all.
Mm-hmm.
And then shortly after that, he is shot and killed by police because they mistake him for being one of the bank robbers from the beginning of the movie.
And that, I mean, that scene is devastating and it is fucking horrible. And then at the end of the scene, again, like the movie seems to kind of let the cop off a little bit.
Yeah.
In this way where he's just like, oh no, oh no.
Oh darn, we messed up.
I shouldn't have done that. You're like, why?
Yeah. Then they revisit the idea of robbing the bank, and they figure that with Frankie's knowledge of banks, they think that they can pull it off without anybody getting hurt. So they decide to do it. They start scoping out this big fancy bank where Stoney meets Keith, Blair Underwood's character, who works in like upper management at his bank.
Keith has this like tiny mustache. The mustache is not big. It's quite small.
It's so cute.
It is. I was not, at first I was like not sure if I was going to get on board with Keith, but then I ended up getting on board with Keith.
He's a little touch and go for me. Blair Underwood, it hot, but I don't know. There's that one scene where he's like, ooh, Jada, your outfit is weird. And then he like makes her change into a different outfit for like the bank gala they're going to.
Yeah, she's wearing like this very like colorful, like, you know, kind of like festive maxi dress. And he has her change into like a little black mini dress.
Right.
Right. Which is not, first of all, he was wrong the first time. The first dress was lovely and I liked it. Mm-hmm. And then there's like that scene at the, I don't know. I mean, I generally like it, but it was kind of like her big night out is to this like evil bankers gala. You're like, yeah, oh, I want better for her than this evil banker gala, but everyone's having fun.
And then you like see the inside of his house in different scenes and he's like, well, it's not much, but it's home. And then it's like this mansion. You're like, what are you talking
you're
about?
Just like, sir. Sir.
Well, like he went to Harvard, so and he calls he business went to school B school.
B school. Oh my God. I had to like rewind and go back. I was like, if that is what it's actually called,
no
I need
one
to
calls
like
it that. Like this, right? They call journalism school J school, but there's no B school or like C school.
I went to F school, film school. Thank you so much.
That's a really funny way for like writers to tell on themselves. They're like, yeah, they probably call it B school. Let's just put it down. What a funny. Yeah, that was a great. And she doesn't flinch either. She's like, ah, yes, B school.
No, she needs clarification. She's like, what the fuck are you talking about? And he's like, oh, sorry, business school.
And then he says he works on Wall Street. And we're like, Keith.
Anyway, so he hits on Stoney and eventually asks her out while they're scoping out this bank that they intend to rob. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, Tashawn has to bring her baby to work since she can't afford a babysitter, and the baby accidentally consumes some cleaning products and they have to rush him to the hospital, and then Child Protective Services take her baby away. So now everyone is even more highly motivated to go through with robbing a bank. So they start to make preparations. Cleo procures some guns and a getaway car.
Some guns from Dr. Dre.
Yes. Yeah. A great cameo. The playing the guy that owes favor.
Right. And has a bunch of guns.
That's such a fun heist trope to me, because I feel like that is like a character that appears in some form in every heist movie of like, well, how will we get item? It's like, oh, guy owes me favor. And then we see guy who owes favor.
Mm-hmm. So then Frankie, Stoney, Cleo, and Tashawn go to rob a bank wearing disguises, and a couple of them feel uneasy about it, but Frankie sets it off. Hey, that's the name of the movie.
I love how much they say the name of the movie in the movie.
Well, someone had to set it off.
Oh, yeah. Well, because when Cleo is getting the gun, she's like, no, I want something that can set it off. And I'm just like, yes.
You're like, yeah.
Right.
One of the many things, I mean, it's like, it's hard not to want to talk about every part of the movie as we mention it. But there's so, like, I don't know. I love that. I feel like a lesser movie would kind of employ some, like, they all know how to set it off right away, but they get like steadily better at robbing banks as the movie goes on, where like the aesthetic and the weapons for the first robbery are very different from the third. And you're like, okay, we're all learning here. This is cool.
For sure. Yeah. The way the first robbery was shot was really cool because it was all one shot. just kind of like moving around the room. There's no edits, and it happens in exactly 60 seconds because you see the shot starts with a clock and then ends with the same clock, and it's 1 minute later, and you're just like, oh, this is good filmmaking. The blocking in this scene, the acting in this scene.
The music.
Oh, loved it.
It's good.
So anyway, so they arrive at this first bank, and they go through with it, except for Tishan, who runs away because she chickens out. And it's a success, and they get away with $12,000. Meanwhile, though, the same cops from earlier, Detective Strode and Detective Waller, are starting to suspect who might have done this robbery, and they think that Frankie was involved.
I have another huge issue with that plot point, but we'll get there.
Sure. Then Stoney goes out with Keith. Meanwhile, Cleo and Frankie want to rob another bank because they need more money to be able to kind of fully leave their old lives behind. Stoney doesn't want to. She and Cleo get in a huge fight, but it doesn't last long. They make up. And then there's this fun Godfather inspired scene.
I had seen this scene before, but I didn't know the context of when it came in the movie. Mm-hmm. So I went in thinking Set It Off was way sillier
than
it ends up being. But that scene is so awesome. It's mm-hmm. so good.
It's a great scene. And also, I had listened to, I don't know how much Destiny's Child you listen to, but their album, The Writings on the Wall, starts with a scene just like that with Missy Elliott talking to Destiny's Child, like the Godfather. Oh. And I had grown up hearing that, and then I watched Set It Off after that, and I was like, oh, okay.
Wait, I never would have connected that. I know exactly. Wow.
Yeah, Set It Off was first, so I think that it came from that.
They were just big fans. Oh, I love that. That's great.
So basically, the group is like, okay, we just need to do one more big robbery, and then we'll be Set It Off. Nope.
You're like, but what about the rule of threes?
I know.
But right, they haven't thought about that yet.
Yeah, they don't know the screenwriting rules at this moment. So they go to the second bank, and this robbery is kind of touch and go. It's lasting a little too long. Their getaway gets a little botched, but they manage to get away with
over... Well, isn't the second one where Queen Latifah drives through the bank?
Correct.
Which is...
It gets a little botched.
Just drives the car into the bank. I love that scene.
Apparently there's like a display of like... teddy bears that the truck runs into, because all of a sudden there's a shot of like teddy bears exploding across the front of the car.
No notes. It's perfect. It's great. And also TT really steps up in this robbery because she is like someone has a gun and someone is going to stop them, but then she's able to, which I really liked. I liked that it was like she got scared the first time, and then the second time she was like instrumental to setting it off.
Yeah, she's pretending to be one of the hostages basically, and then she's like, oh no you don't, when the guy with the gun tries to stop things. For this robbery, they managed to get away with over $260,000. Their plan is that they're going to keep working at their janitor jobs for the next few days while they get TT's son back, and then they're going to leave town. So they stow the money in the hotel where they work at and go about their normal business. Mm-hmm. Then we have a Stoney and Keith steamy sex scene.
Yes. A lot of tight shots, a lot of oil, good soundtrack.
A lot of butts. And then the others show up at work and learn that Luther, their boss, has stolen their cash that they stowed away. So they go after him. They find him. I think it's TT ends up shooting and killing him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They can't find the money, but there is a woman there who Luther was having sex with, and she witnessed the whole thing. So then Cleo gets picked up by Detective Strode and put into a lineup. But she had taken this witness's ID and been like, this is for insurance. Like, if you identify me, I will kill you, is the implication. So Cleo does not get identified and she gets released. But with the money gone, they realize that they have to rob another bank. So they decide to go for the big one, the rule of threes.
Keith's Bank.
Keith's Bank.
I love when Jada's like, not Keith's bank. And they're like, Keith's and they're like, yep, bank. Keith's
bank. Sorry. Now, the problem is that the detectives are already there showing security camera footage to the like upper management staff at the bank. And Keith recognizes Stoney from the footage. And he's like, no, not my girlfriend, Stoney. So the women show up to rob the bank, but because the like cops are already like right there, there's this big shootout. TT gets shot. They get away, and then Tishan dies in Stoney's arms. Another very tragic scene.
It's horrible.
And then they have to escape from the kind of that situation, and then Cleo kind of martyrs herself to save Stoney and Frankie. Stoney gets on a bus, but Frankie gets caught and killed. But Stoney makes it to Mexico, and she's got her bag of money, and she's the only one to make it out. And then the film ends with her kind of driving along the coast.
It's a perfect ending shot. I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that is the story. Let's take a quick break, and then we'll come right back to discuss.
There's nothing worse than wearing clothes that don't fit right. That's why Tomboy X makes size and gender-inclusive underwear, swimwear, and loungewear for all bodies. Queer-founded and run for over 10 years, you can trust they know a thing or two about making the perfect pair. Feel comfortable in your own skin. Shop online today and use code IHEART for 20% off your first purchase. Only at TomboyX.com. Tomboy X. Fit for you just as you are.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
This is Ashley Iaconetti from the Ben and Ashley I Almost Famous podcast. The state of Tennessee is one of the few places where the sounds are just as breathtaking as the sights. Whether that's live music at a historic music venue, the crack of an open fire at a campsite in the wilderness, or hearing kids laughing as they explore what's right around the bend, Tennessee just sounds perfect. Start planning your trip at tnvacation.com. Tennessee sounds perfect.
Where should we start the discussion? There's a lot of stuff here.
This is one of the best casts. Like, it's such a great cast because, I mean, when I've been, you know, looking back and researching Black film for, like, the past 30 years and just kind of specifically looking at a lot of the talent that really didn't get to be in that many movies because there just weren't roles for them. And this cast is just so... It's so perfect. Like, just all of my favorite, so many of my favorite underused actresses. Like, specifically, I think that Vivica Fox was an underused actress for a while, especially like until like leading up to like Kill Bill. But even like since Kill Bill, she's been really underused. Kimberly Elise, who I love, 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 and who was, she starred in the very first Tyler Perry movie,
Ooh.
Diary of a Mad Black Woman. And she was amazing in it. And she, I mean, like, and, you know, Tyler Perry got huge after that. I mean, he was already huge in terms of, like, theater and stuff. But Tyler Perry got huge in film, and she didn't. And I hate that because she's great. And Jada Pinkett Smith, one of the most underused actresses of our time.
We were just talking about that in the Bad Moms episode, where, like, she plays one of the side characters who's, she's like, one of the mean moms. It's like, what, you have her. Why didn't you use her at all?
You know, like, her and Magic Mike XXL, like, Jada Pink, like, that was beautiful. I was like, we need to use her like she's used in Magic Mike XXL in every movie.
She really, like, I mean, I had to look up, I was like, how old is she in this movie? She's like 25, if that, and she's just like on another level. I mean, her performance in this movie is fucking incredible. It's mm-hmm. so good.
Everyone.
She's amazing. And I also love that she got a love scene because I love sexy Jada Pinkett.
Well, I guess that's like a place we could go to, because we see Stoney have sex twice in this movie. And something that I appreciated that the movie does is the way that those two sex scenes are framed couldn't be more different. And sure. because they're told from her perspective, which I feel like is something we lose sometimes in movies, where even if the protagonist is a woman, you still somehow end up seeing the sex scenes from the male perspective for no reason, presumably. But in this, we see her at the beginning. I forget what the name of the car dealership guy is, but
Nate.
Okay. So he coerces her basically into having sex so that she can do this down payment for UCLA. And you see her face during that scene. It doesn't focus or linger on him. There's no over the top, you are there with her, not with him. And then in the sex scene with Keith, it's like the best. It's a corny 90s sex
there's
scene.
A candle. There's gotta be a candle. It's just
there has to be. There's an open flame. Just
there's oil everywhere.
Oh, so you gotta have the
it's
oil.
It's a very slippery sex scene.
And like Blair Underwood, like, because Blair Underwood is so much always like, he's always playing like very, like, Cleo calls his character this in the movie, a buppy, a black yuppie. Like, he's always playing that character, and that character is usually very, like, rigid and kind of like sexless, even though he's so handsome. Like, even I remember watching him on Sex in the City and being like, imagine what this would be like if he wasn't surrounded by white people on this show. Like, what if there was a Sex in the City where I just got to see his ass all the time, and then I wouldn't also have to think about him being fetishized by like white women who just like love the way that he talks, or you know. But yeah, so seeing him get a sex scene is really nice. There really aren't that many Blair Underwood sex scenes,
which is a tragedy, a crime. It's a great I really enjoyed the sex scene. It's so like, it's very of its time, but it's good, and it's like and contrasted with the other sex scene feels exactly right in the opposite direction.
Yeah.
And usually you get those overly objectifying or like exploitative sex scenes from male directors, which this movie does have. So shout out to director F. Gary Gray, you know, legendary black director, for, you know, treating those sex scenes responsibly and being respectful of the characters. And just the entire narrative to me is by and large very respectful of its subjects, these four women. It tells their story. It dives into their characters. We understand who they are. They're so distinct from each other. We understand their motivations, because that does not always happen when you have a male director directing women.
Well, F. Gary Gray is also like, I've seen, I think, more F. Gary Gray movies than not. I had not seen this one all the way through, but he also, if you want to like feel horrible about yourself, he's 27 when this movie comes out. So there's that. And his big movie before this was Friday with Ice Cube and Chris Tucker, which comes out the year before this. So he's just like firing on all cylinders, especially at this point in his career. But
right.
Don't sleep on The Fate of the Furious.
Now, I want to talk about some other people behind the scenes.
Sure.
So the film was written by two people, Tekashi Buford, who is a black man, and Kate Lanier, who...
Caitlin and I were talking, we had a long discussion about Kate Lanier earlier today, because she's all over the place.
Yes. Kate Lanier. So from my research, here is what I've gathered. She wrote the screenplay for such films as Beauty Shop, What's Love Got to Do with It, Glitter, a TV movie about TLC, among a few other projects. So these are mostly movies that are about black women. Now, as far as her background,
she is a white woman.
Yes. So we watched.
Okay. I had the same thing where I'm like 80% sure she's a white woman, but when you search her face, you get the same kind of like unclear image.
Okay, so we were having this discussion today because we're like, okay, we want to be sure.
Yeah.
That this Caitlin found an hour long interview and bravely watched it.
Watched the whole thing.
And Kate Linear is white, but don't ask her if she's white because she'll say, well, I'm half Jewish. My dad's side of the family, there's all kinds of stuff going on there. And it's like, you're white.
She later says she doesn't know what she is. She acknowledges that she looks white because...
But it's because she's white.
She is.
That's why she looks white.
And then, here is the absolute worst part of this interview. She goes on to say that because she has hung out with a lot of black people and that she gravitates toward them, she feels eligible to tell black stories.
Oh, does she?
And, yes. And by tell, she means profit off
from.
Of.
Yeah.
It's the only like extended interview of her that exists. She's being interviewed by a black woman who keeps looking to the camera Jim Halpert style every time starts talking about how she's white, but is she white? And it's like, no, she is white. It's a mess. She negs the interviewer. And then she pivots at the end of this clip to be like, well, Hollywood is ageist. And I'm like, don't change the subject. Like,
do you think that Rachel Dolezal has this interview and that like she like downloaded it to her computer and watches it all the time?
I was getting some Rachel Dolezal vibes from this
too,
screenwriter.
Yeah. So, and then at the end, she's like, I'm all for getting more black writers into the room, but why are people mean to me because I'm old? And you're like, this sentence has been a journey.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, wonderful. So glad that you watched that. I would not have watched that. So thank you for your service.
Well, that brings me to an excerpt from a book entitled Shaping the Future of African American Film, Color-Coded Economics and the Story Behind the Numbers by Monica White Ndonu. I might have mispronounced that. Quote, patriarch capitalism presents several hazards for black cinematic storytelling, representing black males as primarily unsupervised except by law enforcement and correctional institutions does not reflect the historical survival of black families and African-American communities that have depended upon single mothers. Convention maintains that the black man can fix what has been broken in the black community. This assertion becomes particularly significant considering the race and gender of the screenwriters and director of Set It Off. Director F. Gary Gray and screenwriter Takashi Buford are African-American males. The fact that co-writer Kate Lanier is a white female who has penned scripts for several films about black women is also noteworthy. What's Love Got to Do with It, Glitter, Beauty Shop. Since none of the filmmakers on this project are black women, their only intervention is through performance, much like black Americans in early mainstream theater and film. The writer goes on to talk about how black women have been underrepresented, misrepresented, and over-sexualized, even in movies made by black filmmakers, again, particularly black men. And then she says, quote, Set It Off exposes the racial and gender disparities in Hollywood's Ulmer scale, as well as the reverberating effects of those disparities both on and off screen. Employing black people and women either for behind the scenes roles or as actors does not guarantee a fair or honest representation of black culture or women. End quote. So basically she's saying, you know, with this movie, there are black people behind the scenes. There is a woman behind the scenes, but maybe Set It Off, a movie about black women and their struggle, should have been written and directed by black women. Now, I would say that this film does a pretty good job. Like, I really enjoyed this, and I think that there's a lot of great things to take away from it. But like we were already hinting at earlier, like the treatment of like the white male cop is like a friendly ally to the characters is, you know, a little dissonant.
And the treatment of his partner is kind of like a subordinate who doesn't really seem to have any opinions. And I mean, the only other place where I think that it really comes up is with Cleo and her girlfriend, which is, it's a really interesting thing because, like, I think that Queen Latifah is really hot and I can get very clouded by that. But, but like, there is no denying that, like, the way that she is written is kind of like, this idea of like, well, you know, it's got to be like this. I mean, and not to say that, I mean, she's basically playing a stud and she's very good at it, you know, love the cornrows, love the style, love everything. But it's, but it is interesting that her girlfriend never talks. And I think that is, that could be just like no one in the script really having the imagination of like, okay, the stud gets to talk, but what about the femme? Does the femme get to speak? And the answer is no.
She doesn't, to a point where it's like, it seems like they're making a point by not letting her speak.
The other characters even comment on it. They're like, she's not going to say anything. Like that first, the scene when Ursula is first introduced and they like say, hi, Ursula. And like, she just doesn't respond. They're like, she's not going to say anything. Like they comment on the fact that she doesn't talk. And it's like, this could have been fixed.
It just seems like there's another movie where, like, are there just, like, scenes, like, all put together where Ursula's talking and she's, like, having all these opinions and it's just, like, in some other, like, side movie. I would love it if there was, like, a cutout scene where she was just like, hey, I don't think that this is such a good idea.
Right? Or she's like, I know exactly how to rob a bank. Let me give you some do's and don'ts. Like, there are so many ways she could have...
Where's the Ursula spinoff?
It's so bizarre that they don't let Ursula talk. I have a little more context for the scripting process. So just last month, Vulture did an interview with Vivica A. Fox about this movie. Mm-hmm. And so there's like a ton of really fun, like behind the scenes facts. But one thing that how I found out that this movie went through a number of drafts was Vulture asked what rang false about the original script. Vivica A. Fox responds, quote, Jada was a crackhead. There were so many stereotypes of black people. F. Gary Gray was just like, nope, nope. Her brother was a crack dealer in the first draft. It didn't make any sense. He was like, no, Jada's going to be working hard for him to go to school. And her motivation was him saying, I don't want to go to school. And the director came up with what she had to do to get him the money to go to school. Unquote. Mm-hmm. So it's and it does sound like based on this interview, while obviously there were two main writers of this movie, that F. Gary Gray encouraged all four lead actors to ad lib, to add in stuff where they felt like it made sense. There was like I guess that a lot of like the famous lines in this movie were ad libbed by the actors. So
nice.
Yeah, Vivica A. Fox is so she also says that she's athletic. 7 different times in this interview, which is I read true, it, but I just, I'm like, she said it 7 times for some reason.
Love her.
I love her so much.
I guess the next thing I want to touch on is, so this is a movie about like black female friendship, which we don't see very often at all. I mean, Jordan, you were talking about how like between this and Girls Trip, that's kind of it. I mean, even
and waiting to
exhale,
which did on a
they're friends,
episode.
But we talked about this on that episode where like we only see them on screen together for maybe like 20 minutes in the entire movie, and the rest of the movie is like those women off with the various romantic pursuits that they're, you know,
that's
trying
true.
To
yeah.
get with. So this is such a rare story to see on screen, at least in a cinematic mainstream way.
And I feel like, as is always the case, the movie was super successful and it was like a hit and it made its budget back 4 times because like these are stories that people want to see. There just weren't any studios making them. or making them to be released to a wide audience.
Was it in that same interview with Vivica A. Fox where there was mention of this film being pitched to, I think it was New Line Cinema, and being rejected like three times because they didn't anticipate like anyone would want to see a film about a bunch of black women. They were just like, who wants to see that? And it's like, well, a lot of people, because this movie was a box office success.
Well, yeah. I mean, I feel like a lot of those assumptions are like, I listened to a lot of You Must Remember This, and there were a lot of assumptions that Hollywood would like try to anticipate the way that people would react to things and be like, well, you know, the public wouldn't like this. They wouldn't see this. And those were a lot of the arguments that they made historically when it came to like black stories. And I mean, those arguments are the exact same, and they haven't really changed that much now.
And it's, I mean, this movie came out the year after Waiting to Exhale. So there's a really good Clarkeisha Kent piece, and I'm just like a Clarkeisha Kent nerd, so I was excited to read this piece that she wrote. But she basically makes the argument at one point in her piece about Set It Off that Set It Off and Waiting to Exhale are often compared to one another. But she also makes the argument that is like, she's like, I think that it's because there's four black women on the posters, because outside of that, you also in this movie see poor black women. You see like they're all working class people. And, you know, in Waiting to Exhale, it's you're in a different class. You're in Arizona. Like it's quite different.
Yeah, there's really, I mean, genre wise, they're so different. Like there's truly nothing except that they're both about four black women that it's
well, it comes like with black movies in general, especially movies about black women, they just tend to be lumped together as this like giant genre that's like black, this like very indirect, like not really descriptive genre. And it's very frustrating. Because people just be like, oh, well, I'll talk about, like, for example, my pet thing is that I love seeing black women's sexuality on screen, which is like even, in my opinion, like they don't really get to explore it like as in like a way of like objectifying. Yes. But in terms of like black women enjoying sex, you know, like having orgasms, having a good time, I very rarely see that. And when I start to talk about that, will people be like, oh, well, there's this movie and this movie and this movie. It's like, yeah, there's a black woman in it. And yes, there's a love story. But does she come? Like, does she reach orgasm? And it's all, no, she doesn't. So then that's not what I'm talking about.
That there needs to be a media test for that.
That's going to be your test. That's going to be the podcast for you, Jordan, in 30 years.
And I think that the reason people like in a kind of, whether they realize it or not, bad faith way, lump all these movies together is because there just are not enough of them that are like released in the mainstream, which is an issue all its own. It's frustrating.
Yes.
Yeah.
Let's take another quick break and then we'll come right back for more discussion.
There's nothing worse than wearing clothes that don't fit right. That's why Tomboy X makes size and gender inclusive underwear, swimwear, and loungewear for all bodies. Queer founded and run for over 10 years, you can trust they know a thing or two about making the perfect pair. Feel comfortable in your own skin. Shop online today and use code IHEART for 20% off your first purchase. Only at TomboyX.com. Tomboy X. Fit for you just as you are.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
This is Ashley Iaconetti from the Ben and Ashley I Almost Famous podcast. The state of Tennessee is one of the few places where the sounds are just as breathtaking as the sights. Whether that's live music at a historic music venue, the crack of an open fire at a campsite in the wilderness, or hearing kids laughing as they explore what's right around the bend, Tennessee just sounds perfect. Start planning your trip at tnvacation.com. Tennessee sounds perfect.
And we're back, ready to set it off again.
I wanted to talk about how useless cops are in this movie. Mm-hmm. And I realized that, like, it's not just the stuff that we see in the movie. It's also just, like, the context of what they're doing. They're putting mm-hmm. all of this manpower and all of this money and all of these guns and, like, helicopters and riot gear and all this stuff to get four women who just need some money. Like, mm-hmm. I was just...
Right.
Especially like now with the protests and everything, me just watching this, I'm just like, look at all of this time and energy and shit that they're spending because four women just want some money. Like, why? Like, you know, with all this like funding that you could just give these four black women some money and then like right. send them on their way. Like, we don't need to actually do this. And like the end with like, especially with the chase and the manhunt and everything, it's so stupid. It's so stupid to look at. Like, I'm just like, just everybody else could be doing something else. And then like, there's a newscaster and it's like, everybody's watching this. And it's like, this is not new. This is not like OJ in the Bronco. These are just like four women who like need to pay their bills. And the ending yeah. drives me insane because like, it's John C. McGinley. And he's talking to Vivica A. Fox's character, and he's just like, I mean, even the point in the bank, anytime that he's just like, we don't need any more violence, you know, put the gun down. We don't need any mm-hmm. more, no more people need to die. And so he's like talking to Vivica A. Fox, and like, he says that, and it's just like, why are you saying that when you know that, like, immediately she is going to die? Like, it's just so weird to me because why would she trust him? Because when he's in the bank and he's like, you know, we don't have to do any more violence, whatever, everybody's ready to surrender, and then they just kill Tashaun. Like, just a cop right. just, like, shows up, like, after he's already, like, calmed everyone down and just, like, shoots because they're just trained to shoot. And then it becomes a shootout. It becomes a shootout because cops are fucking stupid. And then he, for some reason, like, he's, like, so sad about it and so, like, upset. But then you still, like, spearhead this entire fucking manhunt. If you're so sad, then why do you keep bringing all these people with guns? Like, right. it just doesn't make it's sense.
Especially because I feel like the movie takes multiple opportunities to distance him from what he is in charge of and is definitely doing because he's in charge of it. Where, like, after they...
He started this case. He started the investigation. The chief, who right. is a black man, told him not to. And he does it anyway.
Right. And the whole, yeah, he's like, she's colluding. Vivica A. Fox knew the initial bank robber, so she's in on it. And it's like,
well, he's making a bad faith assumption. And mm-hmm. then the movie has him turn out to be right, which I also don't like. I don't like the story logic there of like, he is making a bad faith assumption, like flat out. But then they're like, but. You know, she did rob the bank. It's like,
yes. That's another thing that makes me really mad about this movie. And it reminded me of, it actually reminded me of Crash. I don't know if you've seen 2004's Crash. Not the good one. The David Cronenberg one in the 90s where people are turned on by car crashes. Amazing film. Beautiful.
Yes.
If you ever want to talk about that one on this podcast, I will come back to talk about the car crash fucking
the
movie.
The horny
that movie
car
is fucking
crash
great.
Movie.
Have you seen it, Jamie? Well.
No, I haven't seen it.
It's a movie
like
about
so
people who get turned on by car crashes. It's fucking awesome.
I also read the book, and it's a very horny book.
That's like one of those ideas. You're like, why wasn't that my idea?
But the bad crash, the 2004 crash. I don't know if you guys have seen it, but there's a scene where it's like Ludacris and Lorenz Tate are just like talking about police profiling and how everyone just assumes that they're robbers and that they're gangbangers and everybody has the worst assumptions, and then they immediately commit a robbery.
Rob someone.
Like, it's so frustrating because he is absolutely profiling in that scene, but the story would have you believe, like, but was he wrong? And you're like, that is not, I don't even think, the message that this movie is trying to say. Like, what is going on?
The movie doesn't really question whether this cop is wrong or not. The movie really just questions, like, oh no, like, why is the system like this? And it's like, well, we're looking at the system. It's John C. McGinley. It's just doing bad things and then feeling bad about it for a second and then going back to do the things again.
And it feels intentional that the most heinous crimes committed by cops in this movie are committed by faceless, like, we don't know them. It's by random, like, guy in background. Is always the it's a cop that we don't know, which feels like another intentional choice of, like, almost like, I don't, God only knows who involved in the production at whatever level made the decision of, like, well, we can't have the cop that we know be the murderer. It has to just be like background cop number five. Otherwise that introduces, like, you know, questions that maybe this movie doesn't quite want to answer. It's so frustrating. And it's also the fact that we get that, I thought that that exchange between Frankie and Detective Waller at the towards the beginning of the movie was setting up something that could have been, like, a really interesting, effective, like, conversation. And then it's just like, nope, we're just going to give you more John C. McGinley than you ever would have asked for.
Yeah, nobody needs that much of him. I've seen every episode of Scrubs. That was enough. And it's also like, now that I've seen him in all these older cop movies, when I watch Scrubs now, he just looks like a cop. He looks like a doctor cop.
He looks like an undercover cop working at a hospital.
Yeah.
Well, there's the Detective Waller character I really cannot make sense of. She's played by Ella Joyce. There's that scene where Queen Latifah's character is in the lineup and they're trying to get the witness who was having sex with Luther to identify Cleo. And she doesn't do it because she knows Cleo's going to come after her if she does. So she says, I don't, the perpetrator is not in this lineup. Meanwhile, Detective Waller is like, she's right there. Identify. Like, she's like,
she's so mad. She's, and it's so just bad. Like, I don't. Like, it would be, like, it once again, in Boys in the Hood, it's made, like, very specifically clear that, like, the black cop character does not like other black people. And that's the point. Like, that's the critique. Like, right. To become a cop, you would have to not like other black people. And so, like, I almost just kind of wish that the movie, like, leaned into this and was just like, she just doesn't like other black women, because at least that would be interesting and that would give her something to do. And it would also, like, explain why she's subordinate to this guy who's just, like, for all she knows, up until, like, everything gets ramped up, who's just, like, harassing these women. Just, like, following them around.
For no reason, just wasting hundreds of thousands of dollars of taxpayer money to just harass these women. And it's the way he talks to her is also, like, so just arrogant and annoying. He's a know-it. Like, there's, what is that scene where they're both in the office together and he, like, puts high-res photos of the four main actors and is like, what did I tell you? And I'm like, oh, this is the moment where she's gonna, like, you know, push back or something's gonna happen. And then they're like, nope, next scene.
I don't like the way that he talks to all the four main characters either. He's so condescending. He's just like, yeah, I know your life is hard and, like, all you have to do is put down the gun and, like, I know your whole life story because I'm a fed and I'm, like, spying on you, but I'm pretending to be a therapist. It's like, no, you're a fed. You're a fucking fed. You're not a therapist. Shut up.
No, and therapists don't stalk you and
They're just still like I know about your brother and your mother and your grandma. And it's like, no, like if my therapist knew that much about me, I'd be like, what's going on?
Therapists famously do not do these things. It's so frustrating. And yeah. And I mean, I guess this might be like an accidentally effective thing where he says at multiple times that he understands what they're going through, but he obviously doesn't.
No!
Or he would not be in this job. Like, I don't know where that was headed, which is kind of wild because it's like what is happening with the four main characters seems so focused and like mm-hmm. so like the movie knows exactly what they're doing with the four main characters for the most part. And then the cop B plot, I feel like unless you're going to make commentary on what they're doing, why mm-hmm. is it there? Like, why?
Yeah. They don't discuss anything. They don't like follow leads. They decide that these are the women. They're stuck with that the entire time. There's no investigation at all.
No, he just does what his boss tells him not to do, profiles, and then murders people. And then at the end, he's like, all right, Jada, you got me. You can go to Mexico. And I think that we're supposed to be like, that was nice of him. Like, I was trying to discern how the movie was trying to make me feel.
Yeah, I think that we are supposed to. And I mean, it's also just like a bit of like Hollywood morality from that time. I love black cinema from that time. It's some of my favorite, but there's also this sense of there's only one of us that's gonna get out of this. Like in any given movie from that time, you get the feeling that only one person is really going to make it. And like, I almost feel like Stoney makes it just because she has scenes where she's just like, you know, don't you ever think about the future? Don't you ever think about where you're going? And because she's the only one who thinks about the future, she's the one who lives.
Right. Okay. So one of the things that I thought was effective and really cool about this movie and, you know, still very timely and relevant today is like just the idea of these characters doing what they do because they are trying to get out of this cycle of poverty and the cards are stacked against them because they're black women and they come from a low socioeconomic background. Opportunities are not open to them for any sort of upward socioeconomic mobility. You know, like they have to rob banks because they have no other choice. They're desperate. Just everything that's happened to them has led them to this. And
I love the line that who says it, where the four of them are finally all on board and they're like, okay, let's do this. They're like, yeah, let's steal from the system that is addicted to fucking us over. Like that feels like the a thesis statement in the movie.
For sure. It's when they're planning the first heist and TT is like, I feel so bad. We're stealing people's money. If we're stealing from a bank, you know, it's other people's money. And then Cleo's like, no, insurance will cover it. Like, that's a ridiculous comment. And then Frankie says, we're just taking from the system that's fucking us anyway. And we're like, yes, like steal from that system, like do it. But yeah, there's this kind of like motif, I suppose, where it starts with Keith, who again, he works in like corporate bank management, basically. He loves banks. He loves money and he has a lot of it. And he is dating Stoney, who she says at one point, like, I'm borrowing pieces of your life. Like, you live this fancy life. This is not my life or background. Like, we come from very different places, basically. But he's like, you know, what's your 5-year plan? Like, what's your future?
I always love this idea of a 5-year plan. Like, it's just
and she's
such a middle class thing that like I just can't even fathom it.
And she says, I don't know. I've like I have no idea. And then she kind of, after this conversation with Keith, she says, hey, Cleo, do you ever think about the future? Like, what's your 5-year plan? And Cleo responds, I don't know. I don't have a 5-year plan. I'm just trying to get through today. And it's like, yes, like people trapped in poverty don't have the luxury of planning ahead or, you know, like setting goals for the future. Like that is a very middle class or upper class thing.
Yeah.
I don't know how much Keith, like, I think that Keith definitely does like learn a lot from Stoney, and mm-hmm. he is like he listens to her and he does take what she has to say in, because the way that that scene about the 5-year plan ends is Stoney starts talking about her brother and he's like, well, great, what's your brother's 5-year plan? And she's like, yeah, he was murdered. And mm-hmm. Keith is like, right, like, it just, so I do appreciate that those conversations, you know, happen between them, and it's like mm-hmm. two different class experiences entirely. And right. But yeah, Jordan, you're totally right. I didn't even connect the dots on that one, where it's the person who survives is the one who was taking in that kind of 5-year plan morality, upwardly mobile and all that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, like, because when you have Cleo, like, you know very early that Cleo is gonna die, simply because, like, in the wake of Reagan and everything like that, we see Cleo, you know, as soon as she gets the money, she gets rims and she gets, like, she gets, like, hydraulics for her car. And it's just, like, mm-hmm. I know that based on the morality from that time, there's no way that she's going to live because she's got hydraulics for her car. Like, mm-hmm. and it's just, I mean, that's the kind of morality that movies were working on at that time. So, I mean, I hope that it's changed. I wouldn't really know because there's not really any recent films to compare this to. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Not that I can think of. I mean, I guess maybe Hustlers.
Oh,
Hustlers, I get, might, like, be.
There's yeah. similar themes going on.
Yeah.
Man, we got to do Hustlers.
Screwing over the system.
Wait,
the
you
people.
Haven't done Hustlers yet?
Not yet.
We haven't done, we've had 5 million requests for Hustlers and we haven't done it yet.
Oh, God.
We're being withholding.
Love Hustlers so much. But one thing that I want to talk about that we didn't talk about is that they get high together in a scene.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. it's my favorite scene in the movie. And I realized that, like, I can't think of a lot of movies where black women are just getting high together, which is weird because, like, that is what I do with my friends. We get high. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just weird.
It's all the scenes where they're together are so great. But that one, yeah, that one is the best, and it yeah. seems like I would guess that there is, like, a fair amount of ad-libbing in that scene as well, because it's just, like, so comfortable and so natural and so it's great.
Yeah,
it's
great. I loved it.
I just want to see black women getting orgasms and getting high. I mean, those are two of my favorite things.
Both do happen in this movie. I mean I guess do we see Jada come? I assume that she does. Maybe I shouldn't make
I assume that she does too, but I mean, who knows? Like, it might have just been, like, really hot and heavy, and then, like, right before she hits it, he's just like, all right, I'm done.
He's like, I'm tired, would you like a Pop-Tart? Not speaking from personal experience.
I love the idea of him
all.
Having Pop-Tarts in the, like, that's like his one, like, working class treat.
Heard of these Pop-Tarts at B school? They're pretty good. But yeah, their friendship is so, I like how often it's put on display. It's a major plot point at different points. And I also love that they are, I feel like female friendships across the board are often kind of written in this very, like, no one ever disagrees with each other way, or mm-hmm. if they do disagree with each other, it's this big end of second act kind of disagreement. But, like, the four main characters are constantly, like, they bicker with each other a lot. There mm-hmm. are certain, like, flare-ups in their friendship, like after the first robbery where TT runs away before the robbery, and then I think it's Frankie who is like, no, you don't get any money, you didn't mm-hmm. participate in the robbery, and
right.
and then apologizes and is like, okay, sorry, that was fucked up. I shouldn't have said that. Obviously, we all want you to get your son back. And, like, just having that, like, really strong friendship, but also just seeing in the way that, like, strong friendships are, where it's like people fight with their best friends constantly.
Yeah, I mean, and it goes to show just how well these characters are characterized, because it never feels not justified. Like, any argument
yeah.
or disagreement they have, you understand where each character is coming from, because you know the character well enough to understand their motivations and everything that informs their opinions and all of that stuff.
Can we go, like, just character to character and just do yeah. a quick rundown? I mean,
sure.
with TT, I love TT so much. I hate, so, like, I do appreciate that the movie, like makes it explicitly clear like why they are put in these extremely unfair situations where mm-hmm. it's once Luther puts TT on the books and she's not getting money under the table anymore, so much taxes are taken out that she can't afford childcare, which directly leads to her having her son taken away, right. which is fucking awful. Like there, and it makes it clear that this is like not a fair situation for her to have to be in, and that everyone surrounding this situation except for her friends are being deeply antagonistic and mm-hmm. unhelpful about it.
Do we never find out what happens to her baby either?
No, I don't think so.
I wish they had, I guess, I don't know if there would have been an organic way in the narrative to like address what happened to that baby, right. but we just kind of don't revisit that at all.
Yeah, that made me feel bad.
Yeah.
I know. I was like, I worry about that poor kid. Such a cute kid. Yeah. And then, like, I mean, you have to imagine that, like, there's never enough social workers in foster care, and just that it's terrifying.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. And I mean, there's also just, you know, the history of like child protective services being weaponized against Black mothers. And mm-hmm. mostly, you know, it's Black mothers losing their children because they have to work.
Right.
Almost like services should be offered instead of
just, you know, taking people's children away. Yeah.
And giving mm-hmm. them to strangers. Yeah. I guess we don't find out what happens to mm-mm. her son. And there, I mean, her, TT's death, I mean, everyone's death is devastating.
Yeah.
But TT's death, and I mean, just that scene, and that is like so beautifully acted by Jada Pinkett mm-hmm. when she's talking about the banana flambé as like TT's dying in her arms. It's just like, it's gut wrenching.
Oh, heartbreaking. So,
and then after that scene, this movie does it a couple of times. It never really bothers me, but there are a few abrupt tonal switches in this movie. Yes. And one of them comes right after TT's death, where I was like crying my eyes out on my couch. And then they got to keep the movie going. So then it's like, do, 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 do. And then it's like back to the chase. And you're like, okay, right. I guess. Yeah, the chase is still happening.
I know. Yeah.
But yeah. And then we have Cleo, an out character.
Yes.
It's a miracle.
In the 90s.
It's a miracle.
Yeah. I wish maybe her girlfriend had said one word or, you know, she's not a part of the group. She's not one of the main characters, but it was a choice, and a choice that I don't necessarily understand. And maybe that was just, but like, there are jokes in this movie, but this isn't a comedy. There's comic relief now and then, but tonally, this is a serious film. So if there's like a running gag, like, wouldn't it be funny if like Ursula just never talks and like that was a running gag and like that the filmmakers decided to throw in there? It's like, okay, weird choice, weird movie to put a running gag like that in the story, but okay. But in any case, yes, Cleo. I think Cleo is my favorite character of the four. I do like them all a lot, but like Queen Latifah's performance is just, she knocks it out of the park. And
yeah, she's wonderful. I mean, Cleo is, you know, she's very honest and, mm-hmm. you know, she's very funny and she's brave. Her death, which is very sad, but it's a very brave death.
Yeah.
Yeah, she martyrs herself.
And she like, to save she, her like she like lights a cigarette. She's just like, oh, I love that. That's just so Thelma and Louise. Just like, let's mm-hmm. go.
Yeah, it's... And they reference Thelma and Louise earlier in the movie, too.
They reference it in the movie. And this movie, by critics, got compared to Thelma and Louise, because critics just love making references.
Well, it's because there are women in a car, Caitlin. That's clearly... her death is devastating, but she gets that kind of, like, yeah, that, like, cowboy moment at the end of, like... She's been put in this impossible, unfair situation. It's being broadcast on news because why? And she still, you know, in the way that she is able to, takes control of the situation all that she can, which like is, it's great. It's great.
You also see her and her girlfriend kiss. You so rarely see, even if there is a queer character in a movie, they often are not allowed to be seen kissing or embracing their partner. And they were nuzzling, you see them kiss, and it's like, I found that surprising for a movie made in the mid-90s.
Yeah, if it were me, I would have added a scene with them in bed together. But yes, it's very good.
I was like, it's you don't quite get the Blair Underwood treatment.
Mm-mm.
But I would have appreciated it. That scene where Queen Latifah is like kissing up Ursula's leg. I was like, I'm interested. Let's maybe like, let's not interrupt this. But 1996 is gonna 1996.
Sure.
But yeah, I feel like the queer visibility in this movie is infinitely higher than, you know, most of 1996, which is great.
Yeah,
for sure.
Frankie, I think Frankie is like, I mean, we were talking earlier about how, you know, like the movie really makes each woman's situation explicitly clear, which you almost never get in heist movies. It's usually a more vague, like, we would like money kind of thing. But for this movie, Frankie is another like very interesting specific character, because she is trying to also get out of this cycle of poverty. She is in the process of making that happen by working at a bank. Mm-hmm. And then through no fault of her own, that's taken from her and she is knocked back down and is rightfully angry about it. That scene at the beginning that like Vivica A. Fox is just like fucking destroys. I was thinking of it like Vivica Fox between this and Kill Bill, like she really knows how to open a movie. Like she can really get a movie started. But like the scene with her and her bosses and the police where no one is coming to her defense. She's literally saying like, I don't even really know that guy. I just live near him and they're just openly discriminating against her and it's so painful to watch. And if it
they perceive her as being guilty by association just because of where she grew up, and she says like, I can't help who I know. This isn't a friend of mine. Like, it's just a guy she's seen around in her neighborhood. And like, they're like, well, you're probably colluding. This is collusion. And it doesn't sit well with us that you know this person. So you're fired. And I love that it's not her idea to rob the bank, but she sort of spearheads the plan of like, well, I know banks. Like, I know that you have to do like, during a robbery, the tellers are going to do this and they're going to do this with their right hand and this with their left hand. So like, we know how to get around that. And that's how we're going to be successful at this, which unfortunately by the end they are not. But
she gets that amazing line at the end where people are giving her shit about the procedure at the beginning, where she was just like, there was like
a gun in my face,
a gun to my face. I'm sorry, I didn't enact the procedure perfectly. And then she's fired. And then at the end, she, even though I'm just like, why does the cop not die at the end? Infuriating. But she gets that line, like, what's the procedure at the end, and gets to throw it back in his face. And
Man, I just wanted him to just like burst into tears and just hit the ground after that.
Right. Like just be, he should just be like, everyone, let's all
everyone
right
go
now.
Home. Like, I'm a piece of shit.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, I don't even think he loses sleep that night. Like, he's just, it's so fucking infuriating. But I am glad that Frankie got a last line in on it. But it's just, it's so devastating and infuriating. And Vivica A. Fox is just like such a powerhouse. Like, it's so good.
Ugh. Like, during that scene, he's like, no, everyone stand down. Fellow police, lower your weapons. I'm going to go talk to this woman. And it's like,
it is I, good cop.
And like, it's, this like, the trope of, like, the white male police officer who just wants to help you. He's like, help me help you. We see the same thing in Thelma and Louise. We see the same thing in National Treasure. Harvey Keitel plays both of those characters, and then among other films,
Harvey Keitel plays good cop a lot.
Yes. So it's just this trope that is a part of the whole like copaganda, like just like pro cop mentality that is so prevalent in Hollywood. But again, I do not understand why that is in this movie that is about like the unfairness and injustice that is the cycle of poverty that so many Black people are forced into, and which is reinforced by police. and why then bring in a cop character who is like that we're supposed to be endeared to and sympathetic to?
Yeah, and it like the whole this whole character, like this whole stock character, falls apart under a moment of scrutiny, but mm-hmm. hasn't stopped anyone from writing it.
Yeah. Okay. So then, and then there's Stoney.
Yes. Stoney, who is, I mean, like the, she seemed, I guess, I don't know. I mean, I guess as close as you could get to him, I think that it's very much an ensemble movie, but Stoney, I feel like probably gets the most screen time out of everybody, but she, we start off by seeing her advocating for her brother, trying to get him out of this cycle of poverty. And then he's subjected to police brutality. He's murdered. I thought it was so beautiful and like a really important thing to include, to watch her mourn him with mm-hmm. her friends. It's a tough scene, but it feels like one that the audience really needs, because it's like she's what 5-year plan, it's taken from her, and then mm-hmm. immediately she has to get back to work and she has to like move forward with her life kind of whether she likes it or not. And
yeah,
and then there's Keith.
And then there's Keith.
I mean, there are some things that Keith does, and he gets like, he negs where one may maybe not want him to. He does hit on her in his place of work.
He's not even doing his job right. He's like, I'm not even supposed to talk to customers, but you were just too hot for me to not talk to.
Which is a classic guy that you don't end up in a relationship with line, but... what can you do? But I originally, because I feel like we talk about this a lot of like, is the romance story necessary to the to what's happening in the plot? And I think that this relationship is important and it has a place in the movie. I was prepared to not think that, but ultimately I feel like it does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess I can very easily envision a version of this movie where that storyline is removed and it not really affecting the whole plot in a way that I feel like there's something lacking. But the fact that it is there, it also doesn't bother me. I guess I'm just kind of ambivalent
about it. I mentioned that I was watching this movie earlier on Twitter, and somebody mentioned how they feel like the Blair Underwood character should have been cut out. And I mean, he has more of a narrative purpose it like in terms of thematically than he does really like a movie purpose. I mean, he represents the kind of life, like in a sense, the kind of life that they could have if their circumstances had been different. Like he's basically just there for the contrast.
Right.
So, I mean, like trying to, I mean, I guess in a sense, the film was trying to, you know, make a difference. Like, you know, some black people have different lives and it's easier for some and it's different for others. Like, I mean, and that seems like a very basic thing, but I almost feel like maybe people would feel differently about him being in it if there was some real conflict between him and Stoney about things. Like, the thing about Keith is that he's, once he learns, like, what he's supposed to learn about, like, you know, working class black people are having a different experience. He learns it and that's really it. And I mean, it would have been maybe interesting if it took him longer to learn that lesson and there were like a few more, you know, like arguments, in which case then the themes of the movie could like show themselves in that argument. But I think that that's why he's there.
Yeah.
Right. But I agree that his kind of background could have been used to a greater effect and function in the narrative than it is. I feel like it starts to head in that direction, but it doesn't quite get all the way there. There definitely could have been other, just more kind of just thematic or whatever it is that gets explored that they don't tap into as much as they could have.
Yeah, I agree, Jordan, that it's like it is this like outlet for a discussion about class to happen. And maybe it like doesn't happen to the extent that it could or should. But I'm glad that it's there. Like there, I mean, a lot of the stuff that's on, is it their first date where he asks her what her 5-year plan is? If so, what are you doing?
I would love to meet the man that does this. Like, that's so confusing to me.
Like, is this what Bay? I don't. I've
is this
never,
a job interview? Like, what do you?
I have never. I don't think like met, much less gone on a date with a fancy banker. But if this is how they talk, my God. But I mean, in that conversation alone, I feel like you get a lot of interesting conversations started. You have the 5-year plan. You have Stoney saying, he's asking her like, "Do you feel free?" And she's like, "No, I feel very much caged." And he kind of tries to like cutesy his way out of her saying that. But when he listens to her, and I agree that there, you know, it maybe there would be more productive discussion if the script had his character push back a little more, because I feel like he represents kind of this like bootstraps mentality, I guess, of like, you know, you work hard and you'll be successful, and without taking into consideration all the forces of like, if that were true, then Frankie wouldn't be in this situation, because she literally worked at a bank and she had that those opportunities taken from her for no reason. And I don't know. Yeah. It definitely starts some interesting conversations, and we're pretty sure that he made Stoney come, and we're glad for that as well.
Yeah, and the fact that he like doesn't really, you know, in the end when she just like drives away and she's just like in Mexico, like he's like smiling when he's off the phone. He's just like, "Yes, this is fine." Like I like that he doesn't really do anything extra, like try to make their last conversation bad or like ask her to come back. Like he's like, "No, she's gone."
Yeah. Which is like I mean, the ending shot, man, I'm like, maybe it's a little corny, but I thought it was so beautiful. I thought it was great.
It is, yeah.
And even the montage at the end, you're like, this is very 90s.
Oh, but and she's like reflecting on all the memories and
all the good times.
Laughing and crying. Yeah.
It's
very pure. I cried so much in the last 20 minutes of this movie. It is just like everything happens. I don't like that it's like implied that the cop is like doing her this huge favor by allowing her to survive and have to start a life in a place where she knows nobody in order to survive. But I do like that she, you know, I mean, she's just like so, I mean, you, how long this movie takes place over the course of what, like a few weeks.
Yeah.
It's like Stoney is a miracle. Like she has to take on everything at once and has to push forward, you know, regardless. And so
she's dealing with the grief of
her brother
being murdered by police because he had the same haircut as the actual perpetrator of the robbery.
Yeah.
She's dealing with being coerced into sex by this creep just so she can get money to pay for her brother's tuition. Like, she's dealing with so much and just the gravity of everything.
I don't think we've mentioned yet, but in a lot of the, it didn't hit for me until about halfway through the movie that like the historical context of this movie is also, it takes place in LA 2 years after Rodney King, or no, sorry, 4 years after Rodney King and 2 years after the 94 Violent Crime Control Act from Clinton. So it's like, also it feels very, usually when movies take place in LA, you're just like, okay, they couldn't afford to shoot somewhere else. But in this movie, it is very intentional that it's happening in LA at this time. And it informs a lot of what's happening.
Yeah.
So any stuff, anything else you guys wanted to hit on?
Well, one last thing about Stoney. She cuts all her hair off at the end.
Yes.
Probably mostly so that she will not be as easily recognizable by anyone who might be looking for her. But she does become the baldest woman in charge.
Absolutely.
By doing that.
I had one more. Okay, so this is just a question for the Zoom room. There were murmurs, I guess, last year of this movie being remade or sequeled potentially with Issa Rae in a production, possibly writing role. And there were a lot of takes on Clarkeisha Kent's piece, was one of them in Entertainment Weekly, arguing that this movie does not need to be remade. It was made correctly the first time. But I guess I'll just I don't know. I sort of I don't know. I don't think it needs to be remade, but I think we should just have more movies with Black women.
Like, yeah, I don't really see the point of this being remade. I just think that, there should be more.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially just watching it right now in this moment, so much of the story feels so incredibly relevant that it doesn't feel like there needs to be any kind of like update.
Yeah, right, no, it doesn't.
In spite of Kate Lanier.
Right. Yeah, what a bizarre person she is.
Truly.
Does anyone have any other thoughts?
That was all I had.
Yeah, I mean, I just think people should watch it.
I'm glad I finally did.
Yeah.
Does it pass the Bechdel test?
Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're talking about robbing banks. They're talking about their lives. They're talking about all manner of things constantly.
Talk about everything.
And it also, it passes many of the other tests, including the DuVernay test, the Vito Russo test.
For sure.
So as far as our nipple scale, in which we examine the movie through an intersectional feminist lens, I want to give this probably like a 4, because it does so well to characterize these four main characters, show the nuances of their friendship, show the nuances of their situation, their desperation, the cycle of poverty that they're in, that they're kind of helpless to get out of. I mean, you know, it's a story about systemic racism and sexism holding these characters back and limiting their options. And for them, the option becomes crime, you know, not because they're inherently criminals or bad people or because they want to commit crime, but because they have no other choice. Again, as Black women, the odds are stacked against them, and desperate times call for desperate measures. And unfortunately for these characters, the law catches up with them and several of them are killed, which is sadly reflective of many Black people's lives, where they're severely punished for just trying to survive. And the systems in place, you know, systems being law enforcement, the workforce, economic structures, etc., these systems are incapable or unwilling to acknowledge or understand that the systems are designed to oppress different groups of people, such as Black people, Black women. And I think that this story really effectively tackles those themes and that reality. And, you know, the fact that you have queer visibility on screen is great. A queer Black woman especially is something that I've seen very little of in popular media and just media in general, especially from the 90s. So that was pretty remarkable for a mainstream studio movie. I guess the main gripe is the over sympathy that the movie extends to the friendly white cop who just wants to help. And it's like, if he, right, like Jordan, like you said, like if that were true, if he wanted to help in any way, he would like defund himself and, you know, give his salary to the women.
I mean, he could have spent all that time investigating, like making sure that these women were okay.
Mm-hmm. Like, right, which is what he claims to be doing the whole time.
Yeah,
but he's not. No.
So I'll give it 4 nipples, and I'll give 1 to Stony, Frankie, Cleo, and TT.
I'll go the same way. I'll do 4 nipples. And piggybacking off what you've already said, I would also say I wish that there were more Black women in high level creative roles on this movie, and that the movie would have benefited from, you know, maybe not hiring Kate Lanier, Mrs. I'm White, but am I? So I understand that it's, we have like F. Gary Gray, who's like truly a legend, and like we have a lot of wonderful people in creative roles, but there, you know, this is a movie that is centered on Black women, and there should be Black women behind the camera as well. Also, the weird cop thing, and also just the failure to characterize Detective Waller in any way is just a dumb decision, I thought. But the performances in this movie are fucking incredible. The soundtrack, I don't think we've brought up yet, but it's fucking incredible. And required viewing for everybody. Four nipples, one to each of the four leads.
Jordan, how about you?
Sure. Yes. Four nipples.
A rousing shore.
Sure.
I know you're probably tired. It's quite late where you are right now.
Yeah, it is late where I am.
I was like, oh no, we've been recording for so long.
Well, Jordan, thank you so much for joining us in this discussion. Where can people follow your stuff, follow your social media, etc.?
You can find me on Twitter at JourDayen, and also that on Instagram, and you can find my writing everywhere. You know, I've written for like Vogue and GQ and AV Club, and I write for Bitch Media a lot. That's a great website. Can't endorse Bitch Media enough. So, yeah.
I think we've cited your work a number of times on the show before, to the point where it's like, why has Jordan not simply been on the show? thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, and listen to Bad Romance Podcast.
Oh yeah, please do listen to Bad Romance Podcast. It's good, you know? It's good. Bronwyn's good. It's good.
Hell yeah. You can follow us at on Twitter and Instagram. We've got our Patreon, aka Matreon. It's $5 a month, and it gives you 2 bonus episodes every month, plus access to the entire back catalog. We've got our TeePublic store, teepublic.com/TheBechdelCast, for all your merchandising needs. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back next week.
Bye!
Is your underwear in need of a refresh? Meet Tomboy X, makers of the original boxer briefs for women, queer-founded and queer-run. Tomboy X designs sustainable, gender-inclusive underwear and apparel in sizes 3 extra small to 6 extra large. Use code IHEART at checkout for 20% off your first purchase only at TomboyX.com. Shop now on TomboyX.com.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
This is Ashley Iaconetti from the Ben and Ashley I Almost Famous podcast. The state of Tennessee is one of the few places where the sounds are just as breathtaking as the sights. Whether that's live music at a historic music venue, the crack of an open fire at a campsite in the wilderness, or hearing kids laughing as they explore what's right around the bend, Tennessee just sounds perfect. Start planning your trip at tnvacation.com. Tennessee sounds perfect.